Welcome to Between the Biotech Waves. I am your host, Nesson Birmingham. Today I have the pleasure of talking to Rodger Novak and Sean Foy, co-founders of CRISPR Therapeutics with Emmanuel Charpentier and ERS Genomics. Rodger is chair of the board of CRISPR Therapeutics following his role as CEO. He's deep biotech experience both in industry and academia, having worked in Sanofi and was a co-founder of Nabreva Therapeutics. Sean has over 20 years of biotech experience, having been an investor, entrepreneur, and company advisor. He is currently chair of the board of ERS. Sean was a founding team member of Nomura Phase 4 Ventures, where he spent a significant amount of time focusing on cell and gene therapy investment opportunities. Together, they continue to work on new companies, in addition to scaling mountains in their off time. They are a rare business and personal partnership that has led to the success of CRISPR Therapeutics today. Thank you both for taking the time. Today, I'd like to welcome Sean Foy and Rodger Novak. Sean and Foy really were the two that sort of set off the whole CRISPR-Cas9 company formation and considerations around it. My intro or entrance into it really came from a phone call from Sean after I'd read a paper, but Sean reached out to me about some IP that they had identified and that they were looking to actually move and develop into a company, which ultimately became CRISPR Therapeutics. Both of you, thank you very much for your time today. Rodger, I'd love to start with you, right? Because really, Sean got a call from you, right? That ultimately led to everything. So could you give us a little bit of background, you know, how you got involved with it and sort of how you've seen, you know, A, your involvement as it actually unfolded, and then B, sort of where we are today and how you're actually thinking about this technology and the sort of editing revolution that's taking place right now.
Sure. It's a long time ago, so I hope my recollection is right. I'm pretty sure.
And you're getting
Sean,
older.
Yeah, I'm getting older. I'm sure that Sean will help my memories. You know, he normally does. No, but seriously, I got a call from Emmanuel Charpentier sometime in early 2012, and she simply asked me, "What do you think about CRISPR-Cas as a potential technology? Can you do something with that?" And I have to say, this call on the one hand came out of left field. On the other hand, I had been exposed to some of her research from the past, so I knew that she was working on CRISPR-Cas. But I have to admit, I personally never, you know, brought that into context with regard to gene editing, an alternative tool to zinc fingers or TALENs. So my very first reaction was, sorry, but I don't really know, but do you have some information you could share? And she did so, shared some information. And at the time I was at Sanofi as the head of anti-infectives, and had the opportunity to sit on the floor with all the disease area heads and platform heads of Sanofi at the time. And I just walked over across the hallway and knocked at the door of a good friend of mine who was heading the technology platform. I said, "Have a look at that. You know, what do you think?" And went back to my office, not thinking anything. And literally 20 minutes later, I'd knocked before at my door, but it wasn't me. He calls me and he said, "Listen, you have to come over. If that's true, if this works, it will be a Nobel Prize." And that's not a joke. He said these words. And so I said, okay, good, this and that. But I was busy at the time. And so I needed someone who takes care of that. So I was thinking, who's around? Who's not that dumb? You know, sorry, Sean. I always thought highly of you. Financing and that. So I called, I said, "Hey, I know this guy, you know, he's not busy, he needs something to do." So I called Sean and I said, "Hey, Sean, I'm busy, you know, I really cannot pay attention right now, but I do think this is really interesting. Why don't you have a look?" So that's how then Sean obviously said he needs another guy, you know, to debate that with. And now you come, Nesson, into the picture. And so I think that's how it started. Yeah. Which I think is pretty telling. I think we all understood from the beginning that there is some potential, but I also think it took some time to really fully grasp what it really means and what you could do with that in the beginning. And if I may say that last thing with regard to Zill, I think that's probably, you know, Anessa would love to include you in that. That was not everybody, you know, who saw the story who came to that conclusion right away. So I think one of the early big achievements, for us was that we saw a very significant potential here and believed in that.
Yes, I would agree. I think, Sean, it would be interesting to get your thoughts, you know, from when you got that call from Rodger and, you know, the kind of what sort of moved from there, because you'd obviously been in the investment world, right? You've been involved with Nomura, invested into multiple companies, really kind of sat on the boards, worked with those companies for the evolution of them. So suddenly you get this call from Rodger, who you'd known for quite a while. You know, what happened in your head and how did you think about how best to move forward here?
Well, I'll just clarify. It wasn't actually a call. I was working in Canada on raising a new venture fund, and I had been trying to encourage Rodger to join the venture fund, and I talked him into coming to visit me in Canada for a week, and we spent time surfing in Tofino, and we were actually walking along the beach in Tofino. He's saying, "Hey, I've got this friend of mine who shared with me this paper, and have you heard about it, and what do you think?" And I said, "No, I hadn't. Please send it to me." And then I started to dig in from there. And I think that, you know, when you think about, setting up or just working in a venture firm, you're really looking for new technologies, cutting edge technologies. And the idea of being able to edit the genome of an organism and to do it effectively and cost effectively, it's obviously a really cool idea, and started to dig into some of the work that had been going on with Talons and Zinc Fingers and saw a huge potential for CRISPR. And that's actually when I reached out to you, Nesson. You helped tap me into a load of the stuff that you had been thinking about already in the gene editing space and the vertical that you're working on with Monsanto. So yeah, that was my introduction to it.
And then so obviously I was working for Atlas at the time, right? And within Atlas, we kind of sat down and said, okay, this sounds like a great opportunity. We really should see if we can invest and help, you know, support or build a company here. You'd also approached Versant. Do you want to talk a little bit about sort of how all of that sort of moved forward? And ultimately Versant invested in and obviously led to CRISPR Therapeutics. But one of the things you did also was the spin out of ERS, or a separate entity, ERS. That's unusual. I've never seen that happen in my career before, right? Where a group did it in the way that you did it. Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about that and sort of the conversations and considerations you and Rodger had around doing that led to it? And it's been pretty successful, I think, for both of you and for Emmanuel over the last few years.
So yeah, I'd been working on this venture fund in Canada and had been working together with Versant. I was working with a large LP in Canada in the first instance, and then we brought Versant in as a big brother to help set up a new pan-Canadian venture fund. And they worked with me for over a year on that fund. And then while I was doing that, this CRISPR-Cas9 concept came along. It didn't take long to sort of drop the venture fund idea, which Versant continued to do and had done really well in Canada. But for me to sort of switch over to focus on the CRISPR story and building out a CRISPR company, this is almost a year-long process, actually, for the pre-seed period, you know, that we started in January. I think I contacted you, Nesson, in the beginning of January, or the end of December, and then came down and saw you in Boston. We started to spend time there, but just the whole pre-seed work took quite a while, speaking with all the KOLs in the space, speaking with companies in the space, and thinking about different business models, thinking about different founder sets. And while we were doing that, Editas had also set up in the interim. And it was, you know, from my understanding, you know, that Editas had only taken on specific IP related to the applications or the indications that they're pursuing. And so, you know, it left us thinking, why do we need and we were working with Emmanuel's IP, who had the full breadth of the patent. So why do we need to put in anything more than the therapeutic IP? And fortunately for us, I think, you know, Versant were super laser focused on the therapeutic applications and were open to us taking the non-therapeutic applications to set up ERS. And that it's been really successful. You know, ERS is focused on making the IP broadly available. We've got over 100 licenses in place now with a whole range of companies from pharma companies, synthetic biology companies, tools companies, ag companies. So, you know, it's been a very successful model that allowed us to really make available all of the non-therapeutic application or IP for people that are interested in it.
So shifting gears a little bit, and I think, you know, it was great to see how you actually managed to get to accomplish that and where it's actually gone. CRISPR. So CRISPR Therapeutics, you guys grabbed the name pretty quickly, right? Started building the company. And you convinced Rodger effectively to leave Sanofi and join the company full time. Rodger, what was going on in your mind? What did you see or what did you hear that effectively made you want to make that jump and effectively jump in, ultimately a CEO of CRISPR Therapeutics?
Yeah, you know, actually, to be honest, I was pretty happy at Sanofi at the time, but being a French company and actually being located in France and Paris, you know, we went through again and again the restructurings, and so it was a bit painful. And then I said, hey, you know, probably an opportunity like this comes once, if at all, in a lifetime. So to be fair, it was not a spontaneous decision. I said, I do this and it's easy, but it took some time. But there was something in my mind where I thought, hey, you have to do this, because if you don't do this and someone else does it, then probably you would regret that all your life. And the other thing was that I understood relatively early on, obviously Sean had done quite a bit of work in the background, but by watching that already at the time, even if not everybody was convinced for sure that this would have this kind of impact. Actually, myself, I wouldn't have to expect that. But you know, there was already almost a little bit of a fight, a war over who gets what and this and that. So there was an instinct. It was probably more an instinct where I said, hey, that must be important. So why don't grab it? And then the other thing is that I felt some responsibility towards Emmanuel. Emmanuel and I know each other since 25 years now, I have to say that. Say we spent many, many years in the US. Actually, I think many people know that. Full disclosure, we were a couple for many, many years. And so I didn't want to just, you know, hand it over to someone where I was not sure would that person be able to do that. And I had worked in biotech. I had rebuilt some of the infectious disease unit in Sanofi. So one thing I knew, I was at least relatively comfortable that I know how to do that, how to build out an organization, how to bring good people on board and simply build a company. And I was very interested in that. And I grabbed the opportunity because, you know, I thought it's probably worth it.
And just for the audience's sake, you know, you had been in operating roles before and in small biotech. And Nabreev obviously was the company that you were a founder, I believe, right?
Yes,
That's where we met. I was at Nomura. We led the spin out of Nabreva from Sandoz back in 2005, and that was actually where Rodger and I first met.
And both of you clearly became good friends. So the thought of building a company, two friends coming together to build a company, on one hand, it's a really nice thing, right? Applaud both of you, you know, the fact that you're willing to do that. On the flip side, there's got to be times it becomes antagonistic, right? And that the friendship really sort of gets strained. And, you know, when I think about these types of companies, especially, you know, that the world that you entered into and what you were trying to do or what you ultimately did, you know, there was a lot of stress, a lot of external pressure, and being under a microscope. So as a friendship, how did that sort of play out and how did you guys manage through it all?
It's such a good point, Ness. And, you know, I think that there were crazy times throughout this whole journey, and there still are lots of crazy times. And in dealing with some of the new work that we're working on together. We really invest a lot of time in our relationships. I mean, I hate to say that it's like a married couple, but I've been married for almost 30 years, And you have to put a lot of work into the relationships so that, you know, we do a lot of stuff outside of work, just having fun. We do a lot of mountaineering together. We do hiking together. We do lots of other activities together. But there's a lot of fun times as well. And that when the difficult issues come up, I think that there's a lot of respect for each other. So we can have hard conversations. We can have conversations that are can get a little bit heated, but without treating the other person with any sort of disrespect. I know, Roger, what do you think?
Yeah, yeah, I think it's pretty, how to put that, unusual. And I think there are two things which have helped. One thing Sean mentioned is respect. And the other thing is also that we are pretty complementary. So I'm clearly, I'll come from the operational side. I'm an operator. Obviously, over the years, have some idea and knowledge about, you know, financing strategies, this and that. And for sure, that is important. But I think in the end, particularly in the beginning at CRISPR, you know, we were in charge of different things. The other thing is that, you know, obviously, there will be, you know, disagreements, you know, things where you simply, you know, believe this is not the right thing to do. And I think if you separate also, that's always important. One thing is professional, and you have to fight your fight and you have to stand up for your convictions. And the other thing is private. So I really think you need to separate that as well. And the last thing I like to say is that I always say this, and I think after all these years, this is unusual. If I get booked at one point, let's make this example, I do something stupid and I go to jail and I would say, oh my God, what do I do? And give Sean all my money, everything I have, you know, take a suitcase, put my money in and say, hey, when I'm out, I want it back. I know I get my suitcase back and I know I wouldn't have to count it. I hope at least, you know. What I mean with that is that if you cannot trust in this environment with all these, I would say, interesting egos, personalities, be it VCs, be it KOLs, be it employees, this and that, then you're done. I mean, you need to be able to trust, because otherwise, I mean, you're chasing something and you can't win that. So that, I think, is probably the secret here. And it has worked really well, I have to say. Yeah,
although I'll add that he still doesn't like me belaying him when he's climbing.
Well, that's a different story.
There's trust and then there's trust.
Yeah, and then there's your life and there's money. That's a difference.
So roles and responsibilities, that must have been a conversation both of you had very early on. If you're going to go out and do this, start this company, who does what? How did that conversation sort of unfold? Or was that one, maybe I should frame this another way, is that one where the VCs come in and effectively say, this is roles here? How did that play?
Should I take
Yeah. You go. Well, I mean, I'll just say at the start, for the first 9 or 10 months, Roger was in employment in Santa Fe. So I was tending to do a lot of stuff at the beginning. And that's, I think you were involved in that journey as well, Nesson. But then once we got in place, then we started to divvy up the roles. I think that was heavily me and Roger having those conversations. But Roger, I don't know what your recollection is.
Yeah, there were even stupid ideas like co-CEO and stuff like that for a brief period of time. I mean, when I hear that today with younger teams, I right away say, forget them. They have no clue what they're talking about, you know?
So wait a minute. You wouldn't have backed both of you? Is that what you're saying now?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Wouldn't have worked well. Would
not have worked well. No, but I think it became also pretty clear that there was a for sure person, as we all know, like many VCs have pretty clear views about the certain things. And by the way, this is something where, you know, it's always a balance as to how you stand up to that. Because, you know, in my case, just from a professional perspective, I was a senior executive before. And then you're treated sometimes like a school child or something like that. Yeah. So, and then in particular from folks who on paper, could be your sons or daughters. Sounds sometimes very interesting. But I think it became clear relatively fast that I'm the operational guy with the pedigree I have, and that would not be probably the right role for Sean. So I think that was not for a long time any kind of dispute.
No, and in fact, actually, when we even talked about that, I think that I was a fan of it not having the co-CEO role. I think that was an idea that we played with. But I think one thing that was clear to me, I mean, you know, I came from a venture background. I spent a decade as a VC and then as a corporate financier. And this was my first operational role. And it became fairly clear pretty quickly that I was not very interested or good at operations. And I think that sort of figuring that out quickly allowed me to focus on the parts that I enjoyed and to focus on those bits rather than to plan on sticking with the company for a long time and being an operating CFO or whatever.
So if I may, go ahead. No, I wanted to say something.
No, go for it.
Just you know, this is a podcast, and I'm fully aware of the fact that people will listen to that, but I don't care. This is the good thing about having done something like CRISPR, you don't have to care so much anymore what people think. So the beginning in particular was brutal because that lesson, I guess. Sean knows it anyway as well. But there was always the questioning, you know, is this a German guy? You know, was it Sanofi the right guy? We should get a head and shoulder U.S. American seasoned CEO, blah, blah, blah. And so there was a big fight and battle, I would always call this, for just justifying why you do this and why you are the right person. And it only went away when other investors then came on board, Bruce and others got more confidence in the team, this and that. But it was not an easy one. And that's actually a message I almost have for young, first-time, whatever CEOs. Hey, you know, you need to stand up for what you want. You need to fight this. And because if not, people will walk all over you. And you probably don't become, even if you stick with that role, a good CEO. Because you are the operator and you're not the investor. And the investor should be investor, not the operator. So that was something which was very interesting and actually, I personally think, very, very, very unnecessary in the beginning, and certainly distracted me and others in the beginning from doing our job.
It's funny you say that. I had exactly the same experience. So, one of the investors tried to rotate me out because I wasn't a household name. And it was, you know, we want someone who is, you know, recognized, big name, running Intellia. So, you know, you make a very good point. And the question then becomes, would these companies, if somebody who'd been more experienced came in or who's more of a household name comes in, would they have actually accomplished what they accomplished? And I was talking to another investor after I left Intellia. And the comment that they made to me was very interesting. Was, we don't invest in successful CEOs a second time. And the reason we don't do it is they've already been successful. They've tasted it. They've made money. You know, they're in a good position. So the fire to prove themselves is actually has lessened. So it's rare that you find, and frankly, I think the three of us are in this boat. It's rare to find people who still have the fire after they've had a really great success that want to go back and do it again and again and again and approach it with the same energy and the same sort of fire that they approached it the first time. So Roger, I couldn't agree with you more. And it was very disheartening, you know, to have that happen or have those conversations at the time. I remember it was emotionally brutal.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, it's demeaning. I mean, it's totally demeaning, and particularly if you do a good job, you know, and when you look at the Intellia, or from my perspective for sure, I'm sorry, Nathan, I'm closer to CRISPR, yeah. I mean, goodness, you know, this is one of the examples probably in our industry where something else has been really game-changing, not only from a performance perspective when it comes to assets, but also how the company operates, this and that. I mean, this is something, and then that's why I really don't like this concept of, oh, first-time CEO. I mean, now the market, we all know that, you know, is struggling to even get first-time CEOs who are qualified or potentially qualified, yeah? And so I think this attitude, it's a question of attitude, you know, must change anyway. And we need to give younger people with the right personality a chance and not just vote them down right away or put them under pressure, which distracts them from what they're supposed to do. I mean that's something I really find very, very important that this will happen. Yeah. You know?
I agree, you know, and I like the concept of exec chair, you know, to help when, you know, when they need some mentorship or some support. And it really opens up that opportunity then to get those first time CEOs in place and the right foundation or support mechanism. But, you know, shifting back, you know, the strategy that you guys started with, putting ERS aside, right, you know, within CRISPR Therapeutics itself, you moved very quickly. And, you know, I remember seeing a number of deals that you guys were signing that, and I think we all know, I think many of the pharma and large biotechs were fishing, right? Who's going to give me the best deal effectively, right? So I think we were all in play. It felt like at the same time with each of these potential partners, you guys moved pretty quickly. You know, obviously you did the Vertex deal, you did the Bayer deal, which I thought the Bayer deal was a very interesting deal. Can you talk a little bit about how you thought about strategy from a BD partnering standpoint versus internal building your own proprietary pipeline, given that, you know, capital was being thrown at these companies, you know, at the time, you know, once an inflection point was hit, everybody wanted to be in. But to the point, Roger, you made earlier, when we started these companies, similar to you guys, I mean, the number of investors that turned around and told me that effectively I'm smoking crack, you know, to be going in and doing this, like, this is never going to happen. It's never going to, we don't believe you, you know, this will never be successful. You know, and there's, I've always had the temptation to go back to some of them and say, you know, do you want, let's revisit. But, you know, it was once the kind of catalytic data really started to come out, and was replicated amongst multiple groups, the capital tide changed. So capital wasn't the issue. So talk a little bit about how you thought about your strategy, both BD and internal pipeline development.
Yeah, I mean that's a good one. Let's start with BD, because there were two phases. The very first phase was a VC driven phase, and you probably all know that, where some of our VCs just were of the opinion you need to validate this. It's so early, you need a deal, regardless what kind of deal. Economics almost not important, just a big name to validate it. Yeah. And so, you know, we at CRISPR did that as well to a certain point, you know, had probably talked to everybody in the industry, like you guys at Intellia probably did as well. But then over time, because capital was available, you know, this kind of sentiment changed. And I like to name someone else here, Sam Kulkarni, came on board as my chief business officer. And I remember he's sitting in my office, and we got off a call with, at the time, full disclosure, Regeneron. We talked to everybody, not only Regeneron, but let's say we talked to Regeneron, and he looks at me, said, "Otke, listen, you might fire me after 2 weeks, but I wouldn't do that to you." I said, "Why?" And so we started a discussion where we said, okay, let's shift away from this opportunistic kind of validating story, because we have the privilege to have cash, but what would be enabling for us? So we looked at something enabling, and now you could argue that Vertex at the time was not enabling because they simply were not in the cell and gene therapy field, but they had a concept and an idea. Jeff Leiden at the time and David Altshuler presented an idea and the concept for Vertex, pitching to us, you know, that was compelling. And so that was something where we said, okay, that's something we want to do. Admittedly, economics at the time for something that early was absolutely mind-blowing. And the Bayer deal, as you just mentioned, was different. You know, it was something we knew. We cannot do it all. It's absolutely impossible. So why not bring it into a structure where, I wouldn't say second tier, but other opportunities we didn't focus from a portfolio strategy on at the time, you know, it would be worked on, and we would still have access to the IP, to the products, this and that. And then it was a good fit for Bayer at the time as well. And so that's why we did these two, I would call them landmark deals, which for sure over time also pent, you know what happens with the hemoglobinopathies, you know, we're panning out. Yeah. So that was really the shift from being opportunistic to being really strategic from an enabling perspective. Yeah. And the
it's
other
an interesting
thing,
point.
Yeah, sorry, Brad.
Well, sorry, but it's an interesting point about that you make about the regenerative deal, because obviously we went out and we did it, right?
I know.
We looked Bayer obviously were obviously talking to us also, and we looked at that deal. It's kind of interesting, just perspective, right? We looked at that deal and said that's a deal we wouldn't do. Mm-hmm. Right. So, you know, it's kind of interesting, you know, we kind of come back to this idea about strategically building companies, about what's the right jigsaw piece or the piece of the puzzle that kind of fits for the picture or the strategy you're trying to build. So, you know, the Bayer one was a really interesting one. I think my concern with that from our standpoint was, you know, the value of what we felt we may be giving up, right? Or we may be partnering around that we felt we couldn't quite price it. You know, there's an element of when I you know, similar to you guys, when you look at BD, right, you're trying to say, can I at least understand A, what I can prosecute internally and build my own proprietary pipeline out of, and then B, do I know the value of what it is that I'm partnering around? And I think that was one where I personally just couldn't get sort of a clear sense in my head as to what actually the value of what I was giving up or partnering around actually was going to be.
Mm. Yeah, but that tells you something, Ness. You know, I think that these are almost personal decisions. There's almost a taste for it, what does fit, what does not fit, driven by right. the senior executive team. And you know what? In many cases, there's not wrong or right. It's also what you do with the deal. It's not just signing this, but it's also what in the end do you do with the deal then? Do you throw things over the fence? Do you get involved? Whatever. I mean, there's so many flavors. I call this the art of deal making. And I think there are a lot of lessons learned. Yeah.
I think there's a book.
Yeah.
Called was, that, right?
Oh, really? I didn't write it. Oh, sorry. Oh, my God. I'm so ignorant.
We'll come up with a different title.
I think we need to.
Sorry about that.
Sean, you know, what's interesting, you know, it's in the strategy and the strategic discussions that both of you must have had, right? You know, you have Roger approaching it from an operational standpoint, you know, and you coming from it from actually an investor standpoint. Mm. How did you think about it, and how, as you guys sat down and discussed how you wanted to build and move the company forward, how did that sort of lens that you came to the table with as to how investors are going to look at this, how they're going to value it, appreciate it, and see the value proposition, how did you approach it, and how did you think about ultimately where you guys came out?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think that... I think that first I like to frame that, you know, I was at the company for the pre-seed phase and then up until from 2013 up to 2015. So for a lot of the real activity that they sort of built out later, I mean, I wasn't there for any of that. That was Roger and Sam building out the company. The part where I was involved at the beginning, I was thinking about, you know, how much money do we need to prove concept with different applications, and what is the menu of applications that we can go after? And so I remember spending time at ASGCT and looking at all of the different ways that people could be using or were using gene editing or gene silencing technologies, and thinking about different buckets of indications that we could go after, just to sort of create a menu of options for investors that would have different timelines, different payouts, different costs. And then as we, I think as a company later, when we were working with Versant about what our first indications were, we were really, I think Versant and Roger were also weighing in heavily about, you know, the idea of going for ex vivo first and not layering on additional technologies and keeping simple what our first indication was and what our, you know, our first route to clinic would be, and both in terms of, you know, the technologies, but also in terms of the costs and resources it would take. It was really sort of bringing in or adding to that perspective, if that makes sense.
I mean, yes, Ness, I mean, the portfolio strategy, I don't know if you want to come to that. I mean, but that's an interesting one to comment on at one point briefly, you know, how that evolved.
Let's do it. You bring it up.
Yeah, wow. I mean, Sean said this, and it was actually something which was not an easy one. And I know that you at Intellia, you know, took a slightly different road and editors at the time anyway. And for me as an operator, it was one thing was very clear we can all dream big, blue sky thinking, this and that. But in the end, us as operators and scientists, we need to translate that stuff, you know? And there were so many questions also from a regulatory perspective. How do we deal with this, you know? How do we get release criteria for our products, this and that, yeah? So, my thinking always was, and then Bill Lundberg came on board as a CSO early on, which was, by the way, also very important for the company. We always wanted to keep it simple and play to the strength of the technology, which we all know still as of today is knocking something down and avoiding delivery. So we had to stay outside the body ex vivo. So it was something where personally I was very convinced. Now the issue was that they said, okay, but what kind of indication do you go after? And then BC11A came up. Yeah, so we had done historic studies and you know, we understood when fetal hemoglobin, you know, stays high, you know, that does protect people from at least the phenotype of sickle and in certain cases beta thal. But we didn't in the very beginning get our head around how a knockdown strategy could work here. Yeah, so we had different ideas. And then when BC11A came on, we jumped at that right away and said, let's put not all of our eggs in that basket, but many of our eggs in that basket. And then the rest is probably history. I think the reason that we were successful is being lucky to a certain point, because I remember when we saw the first clinical data after 3 months, you know, I couldn't believe it. And to be fair, we had all these data supporting this concept. Everything preclinically looked okay-ish. So we did think we do have a reasonable chance here. But I mean, the clinical data blew everything out of water and still do today. I mean, it hasn't changed. Yeah. And so I think the concept of finding an indication which is really worthwhile pursuing, which validates your platform, which is translatable, but also has hopefully at one point not only a commercial impact, but an impact on people. I mean, probably the hemoglobinopathy indication, so beta thal and sickle, was one of the very few which at the time fit that kind of pattern. And so, yeah, I always said to Bill, hey, no, you're in a candy store, man. You focus, yeah? And we did focus. And so that's what we did. And I think, you know, with hindsight, at least that's what we got right, for sure, yeah?
So, in the backdrop of all of this, obviously there was a lot going on, both from an ethical consideration standpoint, and I know both of you spend a lot of time thinking about that, and also from an IP. Let's talk about ethics for a little while. We collectively, so CRISPR and Intellia put out a position piece, right? We're not going to go in and do any germline modification. We're making that commitment. And, you know, it was one that was very easy to actually work on with both of you. And get out there and be very clear early on. And then the work that I think all of us were doing down in DC to A, educate, and B, kind of temper, you know, the expectations or the unrealistic beliefs that were there, that things like The Economist very much stoked on that front cover, as you may recall, right? For both of you, how did you think about the ethics? How did you think about also building a company and having to navigate through all of that in real time? And ensure you were doing the right thing.
Sean, first you, me.
I did not get involved in all of that stuff that you and Roger were involved in, Ness. And I think that, you know, I think that all of our focus was on treating disease, serious disease. And I think that if you focus on treating patients with serious disease and not making any germline edits, I think that, you know, that you're doing good things. So I never got involved in or embroiled in all of that. I do think about it when we start using it for broader applications outside human therapeutics. And I think that, you know, as a company and ERS, we've sort of tried to steer away from areas where we think, we ethically don't want to be involved in. So I looked at some of the gene drive stuff and didn't feel comfortable with that. We've looked at applications in fish and the potential for those going out into the wild, and I've steered away from that. But apart from that, I think that the, you know, I haven't had to be embroiled in all of the germline editing discussions, but Roger has been, so.
Well, the gene drive comment is an interesting one. I mean, we looked at it too and felt, I felt very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
You know, with the thought around the application of it there.
Yeah. What happens when you eradicate all the mosquitoes? I don't know.
Well, right. There's a food. It is a food, you know? Hopefully with the new vaccine data now that's just come out, you know, that will take some of the pressure off. But yeah, the gene drive really, I think, was very problematic. So Roger, your kind of thoughts on that aspect.
Yeah, I have to admit that in the beginning, you know, I was taken a bit by surprise, but obviously I was a bit naive. You know, I was surprised that people would come up with these kind of concepts at this early stage of a technology. But it shouldn't have surprised me, because obviously, you know, when something is theoretically doable, you know, people will do it one way or the other at one point. Personally, I have a very, very clear view about that. And this is not a religious or whatever motivated view. It's just that I think my personal view is that I wanna address disease. Yeah. And I don't wanna address aspects which have nothing to do with that. And also, I think that's another concept. But there you could also say, well, at one point that will be addressed, yeah. I don't think we understand well enough what it means to manipulate the germline. And I don't think it's necessary, by the way. Why would you? I mean, there's so many other ways to help sort out genetic disease that personally I don't think that's even necessary. And the other impression I got is that, and this is was a bit frustrating, there are figures, and this will always be the case in the field, who actually nourished almost this discussion by trying to get, you know, the attention by, you know, putting out, you know, kind of ideas and concept, what you could do and should not do, this and that. And so it was almost a self-fulfilling, self-entertaining discussion, which I didn't like. Having said this, I think it's a very important discussion to have. And I think it's very important that, you know, you agree on guidelines and the way how you do this, you know, if it's done through a moratorium or whatever. I'm not entirely sure what's the best answer here. But I clearly also have to say, like with articles, you know, presented by The Economist and others, that's also, I wouldn't call it a ghost discussion. Obviously, we saw some things in China. Yeah. But it was something where I think a bit more common sense, a bit more, you know, distance and less emotions would have helped to have a discussion which is much more educated and probably more productive.
Are we talking about IP now?
No. Yes. Well, good point.
I agree with all of that. You know, let's shift to IP, because I actually, you know, I look back and say, first of all, I think we were very arrogant, right? We believed that, you know, SpyCas9 was the be all and end all, right? And suddenly, once people knew the signature, they were finding it everywhere, right? So obviously, that's just, you know, grown. The toolkit has grown substantially. You know, the IP we spent obviously a lot of time and a lot of money on that. And that money kind of took away from the application of building therapeutics for patients. And, you know, I don't know how you guys feel. I certainly feel, you know, it's the usual thing that the only winners really in all of this were the lawyers, right, who collected significant fees for it. And then, you know, all the sort of publications that came out around it. In hindsight, How do you look at it? Do you think we did it right? Do you think that there may have been other ways that we could have approached this, or did we focus on the wrong thing? There are times I look at it and say we focused a lot, at least in our investor meetings, around IP, and to me, you know, it was almost secondary to the actual mission objective of the company.
Yeah.
But the focus on it was just huge. And I, you know, I know Sean, you and I tried to figure out a way and had some conversations to see if we couldn't actually kind of work all together, all the parties together, to try and affect a situation that would allow us to be able to move forward, which was shot down. I'm sure you remember that meeting well. You know, in hindsight, you know, how do you guys think about it? And I think, you know, John, I'd start with you, because I think you really were very much at the forefront of this from the start, in trying to help think through this. And as I said, you and I sat in that meeting together and tried to navigate a way around it.
Yeah, I think that it's unfortunate how much IP has played into the storyline of all the CRISPR stories, since it's such an important technology that I think is going to have a huge impact on humans, treating human disease, but also advancing science much faster. But when I think about the approach that we, as in the three of us on the call, approached it, you know, we tried to get the IP together with Broad and were denied. They wanted to do something different with it and build their own companies. We tried to collaborate or to find a way to combine it with, you know, the other IP that was out there on our side of the table, both with you guys at Intellia and Caribou, and various stakeholders found that difficult to see that all coming together. So, you know, I think that we sort of took the right steps to combine it, but, you know, maybe it's just simply the stakes were high for everybody and the stakeholders weren't aligned enough and thought that they could do everything better on their own, on our side and your side and everybody's sides. So I think it's unfortunate that it wasn't simplified, but, you know, when I look at it now, I mean, I don't think it's really slowed things down for the field. And now I think it's less. Well, there you go. Roger will have a different view is coming in a moment. But I don't think it's really slowed things down that much. I mean, there's loads of companies out there that are developing therapeutics. There's companies that have been treating patients. There's loads of companies out there that have licenses to foundational IP, that are selling products, et cetera. So I'm not sure it's really slowed things down, but it definitely has muddied the waters and made it a lot more confusing for people early on. I know that at ERS, you know, we've been providing licenses for people that want access to the Charpentier Berkeley foundational IP. We've been providing licenses to that for 8 years now. And we have over 100 licensees, as I said earlier. So I think that, you know, that it's frustrating, but I don't think it's a storyline any longer. It was a big storyline early on, but Roger,
I agree. Yeah.
Roger, what do you think?
Yeah, in principle, I agree, but I have one or two points, and I wouldn't say I disagree, but I have just a different perspective. I mean, I was not that much involved at the very beginning. I heard of your and also Nesson, your efforts, sometimes involved, most of the time probably more on the sideline. But what I was very involved with was the research and the analysis of what happened in Emmanuel's lab. And I'm not here and I cannot comment on who's right and who's wrong. Probably people can guess that. But I found deeply, deeply frustrating as to how it is possible that an institution like the Broad Institute stages almost PR campaigns around this and really drags this entire field into the mud and just not having a bigger picture. I have to say that this is deeply frustrating. I mean, I've lived that now for the last 10 years and I find this pretty amazing and how people, including Eric Lander, tried to rewrite history. I mean, we all know what happened with that.
That cell paper.
Yes. Right. And I have to say, I mean, that's something, guys. I'm European, and I say that. I love the U.S. The U.S. has given me so much opportunity. I was educated there. I was trained there. CRISPR is a Swiss company, but obviously most of, I would say, the progress made and the impact made is due to what we have in the US system. But I have to say how folks, the aggressiveness, I would say rewriting not only of history of facts, how people get away with that, just bullying others. I mean, that is something where I'm happy that I'm most of the time by now sitting on the other side on the Atlantic because it's disgusting.
Tell us how you really think. You know, it's I think the other aspect of this that's interesting, and it sort of has captured my mind a little bit over the past few years, has been, you know, I remember meeting Emmanuel for the first time at St. Andrews at the conference that was there, and really being struck by her personality, you know, just a really fantastic person, right? You know, the discussions, very scientifically driven. And I would say, you know, really not one who kind of put forward her accomplishments, right? And what she's actually been successful here. And she's almost been sort of, in some respects, forgotten or kind of put in the, like, in the sort of to the side versus, also I know Jennifer very well, Robert, I knew her very well. You know, as we look at the sort of books that have come out, the sort of the overall PR that's taken place there, there are times I have felt that there's been sort of this kind of historical loss that's taken place in this story, right? When Jennifer's most recent book came out, I wasn't even listed as a founder of Intellia, right? So, you know, your point about how things are actually being presented and sort of the history starting to actually change. And that actually makes me sad a little bit, you know? I'm curious to your thoughts on that. Like, I certainly felt that I was at times just being written out, and that the accomplishments and the risks that we all, the three of us, have taken here, right, in building these and moving them forward. And to think that Emmanuel, you know, reached out to you, Rutger, you reached out to Sean reached out to me. Yeah. You know, we've two companies as a result of that. Never mind the discovery, the research that took three, sorry. Yes, I forgot. And, you know, never mind all the scientific research and everything else that went on. That story's never been told. And, you know, and her role, frankly, in all of this. So curious as to whether you guys have thought similarly or whether I should just get over myself and move on.
No, I want to take that answer first. I think it is a shame that this story is never told and it has not been told. I think part of the reason that it hasn't been told is because there's a lot of conflict throughout that whole period. And early on, I think that while people were still working together and collaborating together, it's difficult to tell those stories. I hope that someday it gets told. But, you know, I think that people probably don't recognize the amount of effort that we all went to try and bring the story together in the early days, and how all the founders that ended up in all of these various companies were all being vied over and discussed, and how people that ended up in different companies, like, I mean, Ness, you ended up with Intellia, but how much effort you put into CRISPR in the pre-seed time as well. And I think people don't recognize those stories just haven't been told, but I hope they do get told.
I think, if I may, they don't get told unless we tell them, because nobody knows about that and nobody cares. I mean, that's one of the issues. I feel a little bit like you. On the one hand, I feel dramatically, I really have to say that, dramatically privileged to have had this and still have that experience. I'm still chairing the board and have some other function at CRISPR. So I'm absolutely feel blessed. I really mean that. You know? The biggest experience, I'm a medic, as you know, but the biggest impact for me was when we really treated the first beta thal patients, and I understood the chances that we have here cures. Functional cures, and you know, are really high. I have to say this had an impact, and I never expected that, by the way, on my life and the way I look at my life. That is that nobody can take that away from me. It's a very personal, private feeling. Now, with regard to recognition, rewriting the history, I have to admit this. I'm deeply, deeply frustrated. Yeah. There's also an aspect I think this industry doesn't do well, or our industry doesn't do well. Academia is celebrating in the ivory tower their stars. I mean, when you look at the Wikipedia page of Emmanuel, the number of rewards, prizes, honorary doctorships, whatever, is just mind-blowing. She's now, right now, in Armenia at a big meeting where some of the smartest guys on this planet meet and this and that. So all these opportunities. And I remember once I talked to a journalist and I kind of mentioned that. And this person said to me, "What's your problem? You got wealthy." And I'm thinking, I mean, goodness, you know, how stupid is that comment? But then I was thinking, hey, that's probably what people think. And I think, to be very honest, yeah, if folks like us, and not only us, by the way, there are others like Bill and Bill Lundberg and Ness, I'm sure you have on your side also people. If we hadn't had the opportunity, if we haven't had the finance or the financial means to translate this, I mean, someone had to do this, yeah? It's not about just the CD19 CAR T, whatever kind of study, but do it in a professional environment and biotech and pharma. If we hadn't done that, I mean, I don't know what the impact of CRISPR would be. Probably over time, you know, it would have an impact, but we at least facilitated this dramatically. And I have said this the other day to Emmanuel. I said, listen, you have 100 plus rewards. You got very, very wealthy. I'm so happy for you. I didn't get a single prize for this, not a single reward, not a single mentioning or whatever. Being the CEO or having been the CEO, the startup CEO of CRISPR, IPOing the company, being still the chair of the board, you know, pretty much written history, nothing. And this is not that I look for that or I think whatever. But that's crazy. And now the only reward I get, and Sean as well, Nesson, sorry, yeah. Is that we are invited to Stockholm to join the Nobel Week in December. I am very happy about that. I'm looking forward to that. But all in all, when you look at this, I think our industry sucks. With regard to that. Sorry. I mean, I thought this is crazy. This is absolutely crazy. Yeah. Sorry.
I love you, Kander. This is great. I know. Well, at least you appeared in the first edition of Jennifer's book. So, you know, you
know what? I never read this. And I tell you what, because I was interviewed by Walter Isaacson and he told me all these stories. And I can say that. I mean, goodness, what I heard then, what he wrote, you know, Walter, don't call me again.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. So, I mean, ridiculous. I mean, that's not journalism. Yeah. That is not so, okay. Yeah.
So let's, you know, I want to pick up a point about the, you know, you start these companies and, you know, this is not exceptional, right? To us, right? You have an idea, you develop it. It goes into a patient. That first kind of dosing period, obviously very scary, right? And you're kind of wondering, how is it going to go? What's going to happen? And then you see the data from the initial clinical trials coming through that your thesis, you know, ultimately is proved out. At you know, the comment, Rucker, that you make about the feeling of just relief, right? And also, you know, that you actually have done something, like you feel like you've really kind of moved the ball forward from a healthcare standpoint is just immense. I mean, seeing that TTR data similar to the data you referenced, you know, seeing that data come through was just, after all the work, all the effort, you know, just was huge and a huge relief also, because, you know, very scared that the data wouldn't be good, you know, ultimately. So, you know, we are very privileged. We're very lucky to have worked in this space and been there at the very start. Looking ahead, both of you are involved in now company formation, starting new companies, looking at new management teams. Rucker, you were just talking about hiring people in earlier on a call. Where do you see our industry going, and what are the challenges now that we need to sort of overcome to really realize what I would classify as healthcare democracy for all?
Wow. Guys, I'm probably, again, a little bit provocative, but as I said at the very beginning, I don't care anymore. So first of all, I think, seriously, I mean, I've been in the industry, started in the industry in 2005, so in the biotech industry, and when I compare it now to the industry we have now, is no comparison. I mean, biotech, from my perspective, it's much more professional. We are really, really in the position to hire the very best people into the industry. However, and now comes the big however, what has happened the last two and a half years has poisoned some of that, some of these achievements. Investors, you know, seeding companies, doing little A, if at all, crossovering and then IPO companies, you know, has really hurt us. Yeah. And now, I mean, I find this pretty cynical when now crossovers organize whatever kind of podcast and webcast and whatever and try to explain what happened. But then when you look at them, you say, hey, guy, you know, you did it. You were involved. You know, you drove that. And I think this is not good what happened in the industry. And I think the other thing is that we have a problem with people. You know, it is not only in Europe, but also the US. We have such a significant amount of companies, some better than others, you know, but we don't have enough talent to run and manage these companies. Because what we need to keep in mind, even if these are sometimes smaller companies, the impact you have as a leader is huge. And so, and the responsibility you have is huge, because not only that we are one of the most regulated industries, but we deal with people. I mean, we cannot afford to make too many mistakes. And you said this before, Ness, before the data came out, I was not only nervous because, you know, maybe the data don't come out the way I wanted them to come out, but I was also nervous because we put something into people which hadn't been done before. So I was also nervous about safety considerations. Yeah. And I think this industry needs to focus again on quality and needs to give young people, younger people, a chance. You know, you mentioned it again before, executive chair concepts, all these kind of things. I like that as well. It's not the solution to everything, but we need to make, we need to understand that we're dealing with people. In the end, for sure, we need to make sure this is our model to provide returns on investment to our investors. But in the end, we have most of us, most of what we have is responsibility towards people. And the last comment I make, I love advanced therapies. I love cell and gene therapy, but we need to find ways to make them accessible also to countries and people who are in dire need of that, but can't afford it. And so that's another big, big thing I think this industry should be much more creative around. And that's one of the biggest tasks I see going forward, if these new modalities should really have a major impact. Everybody should benefit from that, not only a select group of people.
I totally agree. And that is a big challenge in our industry right now. Sean, last comment goes to you. What's your sort of view and your take on where we're going and the execution of all of this?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, so I've been in the industry for 25 years now, since...
Oh, you look so much younger.
I know. It's all of the white hair and the white beard.
And... He's using a filter. He's using a filter on his Zoom right now.
I've been in the industry for 25 years, and this is probably the most exciting time in that 25 years. The number of, there's been an explosion in the number of companies over the last 5 years. The amount of capital is, never been as significant as it is now. The number of companies, the people, and it's created some constraints. You know, obviously we have huge issues hiring talented people. I think that you were going to see a number of companies perhaps not getting refinanced. But all of that aside, I think it's just sort of the growth of the industry. It's sort of an ebb and flow. And we've had those points in time previously, you know, in 2000, after the dot-com bubble burst in 2007, and several other points since then, and to a lesser extent. But I've never felt as optimistic about it as I have now with the number of tools in the toolkit, the new technologies that are coming out. So I think that it's a great time to be in this industry. And I would hope that, people see it as that and not focused on the current market environment or the massive downturn in the NASDAQ over the last year or so. I hope they don't focus on that, but look at the number of new medicines that are being made, the new technologies that are out there, the the number of people that are now playing in the space and the investors and the executives and also the reorientation of academia towards more applied tech, more applied ideas and translational ideas. So I think those are all real pluses for us. So I'm really optimistic.
I agree. You know, I mean, you are the grandfather of the three of us now, but I think we've only been doing it 23 years, right? So, but, you know, I couldn't agree with you more. It's never been more exciting, but we still have some challenges we need to overcome. I think, Rutger, I want to pick up on one point that you made about the capital flows, right? And the investments up, down, sort of these high valuations, almost priced for pure perfection, right? I kind of take it, you know, we've now been through, all three of us been through multiple cycles here, and something I've talked to some of the equity research analysts and bankers about. When you see these massive capital inflows into our industry, though, it does drive novel, you know, novel technologies, the development of platforms, new discoveries. So, you know, there is an element that I completely agree with you. Like, valuations got way out of whack. You know, they were priced silly numbers. But that capital inflow, I do think, will spur sort of that next generation of technologies and drugs that, you know, that need that type of investment to really get these platforms up and going when they're years away from even identifying a development candidate.
No, I agree with that, Ness. And also, I think since the industry, I call it always, is more and more professionalized, you know, to be quite honest, you know, companies, you know, starting, oh, we got a seed for 5 million and A for 20 or 15, you know, something what happened at the time when I started in the industry. Today, you don't even have to start with that. You need just different kind of capital to attract different kind of quality people, this and that. And so it's very, very capital intense. But I think, I personally agree with that, what you guys just said. I think it's a super exciting time, but we do have challenges. And I think we need to rethink the model in certain ways, and again and again and again, give younger people a chance. You know, don't come from your pure investorship perspective. We need them, because without them, you know, we won't have enough talent driving these things forward. Yeah.
Yes, I agree. Thank you both. This was wonderful. I really appreciate you both taking the time for this. I know that you're very busy, so thank you for it. And, you know, let's keep on building new companies. It's exciting times.
Thanks, Ness. And lovely speaking.
Thank you, Ness.
Good to talk to you guys. Thank you for listening to Between the Biotech Waves.